take a walk down the cereal aisle of, well, any other aisle for that matter too, but go down the cereal aisle in the supermarket and one thing will become abundantly clear. We want choices. Dozens upon dozens of brands line the shelves. With cereals, we have plain flakes, we have flakes with frosting, flakes with brown sugar coating, flakes with little crunchy oat bundles. We have multiple varieties of oaten toroids in so many different weight bags and boxes. We have sugar-laden cereals, cookies, loops, neon-colored lumps of morning fuel. Just one aisle there shows our desire for maximum choice. Some of us want quality. Some of us want healthy cereals. Some of us want quantity. Some of us want nothing but pure sugar to get us moving in the morning. And sometimes we try to balance the two, those options as we go. But choice is what we want. And producers are all too happy to provide. After all, our desire for this or that is a company's opportunity. Those producers learn to give us a choice for the fad, the impulse, the staple, and the luxury. And fortunes are made and lost on what we choose. So if we want choice, these companies are going to work to bring us as many choices as possible. You know, I remember growing up hearing, back before the wall falls and the Soviet Union collapses, but I hear tales of the Soviet Union and some of the most appalling tales, at least from the teller's point of view, was that there was no choice. Can you imagine that? The person would say. Then to add insult upon injury, for no choice, you have to stand in line for hours sometimes to get what you needed. And we began to equate freedom with abundant options. Simple as that. But it isn't just food. It's everything. We want options for all things. Cereals, pastas, television, cell phones, restaurant menus. I mean, one of the ways we judge a restaurant is how many offerings are on that menu. Movie theaters. We don't just have a movie playing or two movies. But we've got 12 movies playing. We revel in the potential of every situation. But we realize, of course, that every time we make a decision, we do in fact limit ourselves. Some choices rule out other possibilities later on down the road. The more specific we come, the more we are locked in for the future. We even begin to see this reality play itself out in relationships. We hear it from time to time. How many people refuse to commit to a long-term relationship or marriage because they just can't get past the feeling that Mr. and Mrs. Right is out there? How can they commit to any single person when it might limit their options later on? But a life of limitless options is a fantasy world. Reality is created by the very limiting of our choices, by the removal of options and forging ahead. And inasmuch as we have created a marketplace for religion with the proliferation of denominations that seek to offer as many theologies and styles of worship and small groups and so on, so many other options, no matter the cost, as long as we have all those choices, as many choices as there are people, we've continued this trend into our lives of faith. We're left with a funny view of religion. Oftentimes we get what's called sort of the wagon wheel model of religion, the one that allows us to believe adherence to different religions are all traveling different paths like the spokes of a wagon wheel to get to one hub, God, our Creator. And we can hold on then to a view of a smorgasbord of religion which allows us to pick and choose what we want to believe and what we want to practice. Even if we move outside of the realm of one religion into another, lines blur. In fact, for some people to begin to make claims of truth on behalf of any single religion is scandalous. It's a stumbling block. It's not to say that there's not meant to be respect for folks who believe in other religions, but the move into a postmodern world allows us to begin to create subjectivity among one another's, and what really matters is what I believe, not the truth claim that exists. It gives us options, even if they get a little strange. And yet, here's God focusing on one particular person, Abraham, in Genesis today. Well, Abram, in this case. His name's not yet been changed. And God, in his effort to save humanity from the mess of sin, has now turned in this tale in Genesis to the choosing of a people. He created humans, they fell. And then there's a ever downward spiral after the fall. They turn on each other. They try and raise themselves up. God saves only a righteous family, destroys the world with the flood, brings them back, and it's still bad. So he moves to choosing this people. The people will be an offspring of the up until now childless Abram and Sarai. God promises to Abraham more descendants than Abram can count and a land to dwell in. God says, in effect, that he will be their God and Abram and his descendants will be his people. Later in this story, we hear one more bit of this covenant that while God blesses this people, all the nations of the world will be blessed through them. God doesn't hold to a vast number of choices. In an effort to save all, God chooses one. To embrace all, God singles out one family. God would seem to work contrary to our notions of fairness and inclusiveness. Of course, when humans turn exclusive, the result is almost never good. But God is able to use this particular family to raise up a holy people, a people set apart for a particular task, the blessing of all people, by bringing about their salvation, their redemption from the tyranny of sin. It is from this people, after all, from whom Jesus comes, the one chosen and anointed to fulfill this covenant. God again chooses one out of the chosen, one who, as Son of God, will be able to save the whole world. God is not pleased to dwell with the mere potential to save the world. Rather, God makes the choice that is necessary to bring it about. And that choice of Jesus involves the movement down a particular path, one from which Jesus has little or no freedom. Jesus moves toward Jerusalem. The Pharisees show up and try to warn Jesus, "Herod wants to kill you." And Jesus sets them straight, "Tell that fox I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing." Jesus does not heed their warning, but instead moves straight towards it. His path is set. While he laments over the brokenness of Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets, he moves there nonetheless toward his death, through which God will open up the covenant for all people, through which God has chosen us to be a holy people. In the waters of baptism, Jesus cuts a covenant with each of us, incorporating us into his family, begun long ago with a childless couple. God chooses us, each of us, naming us as his own, uniting us to the death and resurrection of Jesus, placing us on the path toward the promised land of the resurrection. As much as we want to believe that all of our options as they remain as they were before, the reality is they do not. When God places us on the path as one of his children, some options are no longer available to us. For many people, folks outside as well as inside this family, this is difficult. We're not free to ignore our neighbor. But instead, God places us on the path so that we might love our neighbor. When suffering harm and injury from others, God calls us to lead a life of forgiveness. God calls us to lives of faithful marriage or singleness. God calls us to trust not in our riches or our own power or our own selves. And for many of us being set on this path, we fear that our freedom is being taken from us to be who we are. It seems that God is in fact taking away our options. But the promise that God makes is that in the choices he makes, we find our true freedom. The life God calls us to is the way to loose the bondage of this world, destroying the power of sin that holds us in bondage. For we have access through Christ to the power of God. We are given God's name to call upon in every need. The choice that God makes for us is the one that brings true life and freedom for us and for the world. Thanks be to God. Amen.